Happy Saturday and thank you for joining me today. In Scotland, there is a small town named Dunblane. And Dunblane is just completely gorgeous. A beautiful landscape with many historic landmarks and a close sense of community. It is one of the most peaceful places on earth. In fact, Scotland ranks number 10 in the world for the most peaceful places to live. In fact, it was always that way until one Wednesday in March of 1996. It was on March 13th, 1996. It started off as a normal day for 11-year-old Stephen Hopper. He woke up, he got dressed, and, you know, conceivably begged for more time, you know, because it was way too early to be up. All the things you do, you know, when you're typically young and dreading school at that age. But not too long after his morning routine, young Stephen found himself in class when he saw something. It was 9:35 in the morning. Stephen was sitting adjacent to the school gym, so he had a pretty clear eyesight of what was going on. And as he sat there, this person was getting closer and closer, and he ducked. He immediately got under his desk because he knew what he saw, and he knew that he was in danger. What 11-year-old Stephen Hopper saw that caused that immediate consternation that made this not such a normal Wednesday was a gunman. A 43-year-old man heading toward him in clear direction named Thomas Hamilton. And he was firing everywhere. Everyone heard it. A student at the school who had been sent out on an errand by a teacher on that morning saw the gunman and was shot at, but the bullet missed them, only to be hit by glass. After rapidly firing indiscriminately, he then entered the school gym. This is from the official report on the shooting. I will warn you that this is very, very harrowing. So if you want to pause or just gather yourself for a second. It reads, quote, "The children cowered on the floor, lying helplessly in pools of blood, hearing the screams and moans of their classmates in the gym, and waiting for the end or for help. Thomas Hamilton walked up the east side of the gym, firing 6 shots. He then advanced to the middle of the gym and walked in a semi-circle, systematically firing 16 shots at a group of children who had either been disabled by the firing or who had been thrown to the floor. He stood over them and fired at point-blank range." Whew. Hate doing episodes like these, but this is an important story to tell. Just completely gruesome and harrowing. The report by the government, the official report by the UK government, goes on to describe the response from the faculty and staff in the building at the time as the shots were fired. Quote, "Mrs. Agnes Olsen, the assistant headmistress, was making her way across the playground from her classroom when she heard several sharp metallic noises and screaming coming from the gym. She ran along a corridor and saw what she thought were cartridges lying outside its doorway. Realizing that something dreadful was happening, she ran back to the office at the head of the headmaster, Mr. Ronald Taylor, who was making a telephone call. The call began at 9:38 a.m. He was conscious of hearing noises like indistinct bangs. This puzzled him, and his reaction was to think that there were builders on the premises about whom he had not been informed. Miss Olsen entered his office in a crouched position, saying that there was a man in the school with a gun. Mr. Taylor cut short his call and made an emergency call to the police, which was received at 9:41 a.m. He then ran along the corridor to the gym. On the way, he heard no further noises. A student teacher told him that he had seen the gunman shooting himself. Mr. Taylor's estimate was that some 3 minutes had lapsed between his first hearing the noises and being told by the student teacher. Mr. Taylor burst into the gym. He was met by what he described as, quote, a scene of unimaginable carnage, one's worst nightmare. He saw a group of children on the right-hand side of the gym who were crying and obviously less injured than the others. He asked the student teacher to take them out of the gym and give them comfort. He then ran back into the office and instructed the deputy headmistress, Mrs. Fiona Eddington, to telephone for ambulances. The call was made at 9:43 a.m. End quote. It was not too long after that call that a barrage of ambulances and police cars showed up, along with panicked and devastated parents. 16 children had been killed in 3 minutes. 16 children shot at point blank range. All of them 5 years old. And then, as always in these stories, the gunman turned it on himself. 13 others were wounded in this horrific, horrific atrocity in Dunblane. This quiet, small town. The gunman had 4 pistols and 743 rounds of ammunition. The lives of 29 families were forever changed. That includes the dead and the injured. And the question always is, in circumstances like these, how did a guy like this even get all those guns? And the answer always is, it was legal. There were loopholes. He bought them without turning any heads. It was perfectly lawful for him to walk into a gun store, purchase those 4 pistols and 743 rounds of ammunition, and walk back out of the gun store without turning any heads or without anyone questioning that. No, because that was perfectly legal at the time. Mind you, again, this shooting happened in Dunblane, of all places. One of the most peaceful places on earth, ranking number 10. It was completely devastating. Shook the whole community. They did cry. They did pray. But what they did with that pain, rage, and shock was galvanize. What the people of Dunblane did was say no more. And not just no more, but this has to stop. We will not have this happen again. We will not have another school shooting. We will not sit down and just let this happen again. For another guy to get a gun and murder innocent children. A group of mothers organized and got together to create something called the Snowdrop Campaign. It was significant because Snowdrop was the only flower in full bloom in Dunblane at the time of the school shooting. It was remarkably emotional, you know, for a concerted campaign like this, but they were intentional and united in their movement. First of all, how was Hamilton even able to get weapons so fast? Well, the background system was flawed. The background check system was so flawed that it would not catch certain things. You know, apparently he was known for perverted actions towards young boys. Police did not know about that, nor did it come up in his background check when he was purchasing the weapons. So that was something they were going after more aggressively and demanding change. Serious background checks that would catch everything. The second thing that they wanted to do was get rid of whatever weapons that this guy had. Ban them completely. And there was success on a large part and prevalence in that campaign, initially gaining 705,000 signatures. Now that's more than a quarter. That's more than 500,000. They took it to the conservative government, which said, no, we're not going to ban those guns, but we'll ban like the bigger ones just like them. I mean, and yes, it was a letdown because they were pushing for all handguns to be banned, not just the larger ones, but in the event that something like this were to happen again, you know, there would be no handguns. So they persisted. And as part of this nationwide campaign, a poster featuring a blackboard that had been, that had said ban all handguns written on it was in chalk. It was written by a child. It was not long after the Snowdrop campaign was launched that there was a devastating shooting in Australia. 35 people killed. The shooter, described as having the IQ of an 11-year-old, forced the government's hand. Immediately, the Australian government outlawed automatic and semi-automatic rifles in addition to pump-action shotguns. The government also confiscated more than 640,000 weapons in a reversal of a buyback scheme. They really drilled down. A mass shooting happened. The people say no more. The government bans the weapon. It's that simple. Yet not everyone saw it that way. Certainly not the gun lobby. Because the gun lobby likes to feel like they're immune from things like this. And most of the time, because no action is ever done, and we say our prayers and our thoughts and we march, yet our leaders do not act. Most of the time, because of that result of inaction, the gun lobby is immune from situations like these where they have to be held accountable. It was because of that that the mothers of this group, the Snowdrop Campaign, they actually organized to create this poster featuring a little girl who had died in the shooting. It says, quote, 5 months on, the gun lobby can breathe a sigh of relief. Emma can't. Face the facts, ban the gun. End quote. Whew, this is just a powerful, powerful poster. A school shooting victim. Little girl named Emma. A concerted effort by a group of mothers who rallied together in the face of grief to demand a better and more secure life for not only their community, but for the future of all children who grew up in Dunblane. And hopefully to send a message to the world, creating a campaign to make sure that nothing like this would ever happen again. Nothing. In 1997, there was a power change. The Conservative Party was out, and the Labour Party was elected, beating the Conservatives in a landslide. The final results were 419 to 165. They got absolutely shellacked. And it was with that renewed persistence and purpose that the mothers of Dunblane, with that new hope, the mothers of Dunblane returned to Parliament with more fervor and passion in their bones than before, and they pleaded their case once again. If this weapon is banned, no more innocent children have to die. It was with that power change and that insistence that the United Kingdom officially banned all private handguns. It was a monumental decision. All private handguns banned. More than 162,000 handguns were instantly surrendered to the police, and the Snowdrop Campaign had disbanded because they succeeded in getting what they sought for. They succeeded in getting the very weapons that killed their children. On a normal Wednesday in March, on what would have just been a normal school day for them in March, little kids going to gym class, just starting gym class, school had just started. 16 5-year-olds gunned down, including their teacher, and 13 others wounded. One of the mothers of this group said that it was a bittersweet feeling and that they were ecstatic that the outcome had been good, that private handguns had been banned, but they were heartbroken as to why it had to happen, that they had to lose their babies to send a message. To this day, the Snowdrop Campaign ranks today seriously still as one of the most successful grassroots campaigns in the UK, in the world. That was 26 years ago. According to the CDC, over the past several years, with England, Scotland, and Wales combined, there have been 30 gun deaths a year. Let that sink in for a second. 30 gun deaths a year compared to the more than 40,000 lives lost to gun violence just this year in the United States alone, with more than 632 mass shootings. It was not too long after Dunblane in 1996 that we had Sandy Hook in 2012. Sandy Hook, 20 first graders killed, 6 faculty and staff members also murdered. Just 11 days before Christmas. This week was the anniversary of that shooting. Sandy Hook, 20 first graders killed, 6 staff members also killed as well. It was that moment in our time as a country, in our time as a nation, that President Obama got up and he stood and he spoke about this, emotional as not only the President of the United States of our country, but also as a father of two young girls at the time. President Obama stood up in the press room of the White House, gave that speech, teary-eyed, holding back tears, and he spoke. And it was in a moment like that, whereas to say that it had to come to this. We have lost children. We have lost 20 first graders and 6 faculty members in a school. Are we going to take action now? Are we going to act? Are we going to ban certain weapons in the United States? Are we going to push for more comprehensive and deeper background checks? The United States did not act after Sandy Hook. We did not act. 20 first graders killed. 20 first graders. Nothing happened. There were marches. There were prayers. There were thoughts. But there was no legislation. In the years past since Sandy Hook, we have had Uvalde. Uvalde, Texas, May 24th, 2022. 19 kids murdered. 2 staff members also killed. Before that, we had the Orlando nightclub shooting. 2016, 49 people killed. Las Vegas, 2017, 60 people killed. Hundreds injured. Virginia Tech, 32 people killed. More injured. Sutherland Springs Church, 25 killed, 2017. El Paso Walmart, 23 people killed. More injured. Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, 2018, 17 killed. I could go on and on and on with the list of shootings that have happened just this year. Shootings that have happened last year as well. Shootings that have happened, you know, within this whole decade. But we do not have time for that because I'd be talking for the rest of the show and quite frankly, even longer. The list is long, but the legislation does not exist. The lives that have been claimed to gun violence in the United States since Dunblane is astronomical. It was just 3 years after Dunblane, I believe it was in 2000, that there was a march. There was a march full of a bunch of moms to demand action for gun violence in the United States. That was in 2000. It's 2023 now. Still nothing has happened. We can pray. We can cry. And we can think about the victims in these massacres, but the real action, the real way to get change is to make change and is to create change, not just by sitting down, you know, not just by being desensitized to things like this on our TV screen, but to really understanding why these things happen, to be insistent and also to be vocal, but also to be active in what exactly we are going to do to solve this problem. If there is an issue and we continue to do the same thing, we will continue to get the same outcome. There will be no resolution. It is only in the US that when shootings happen, mass shootings, when our children are killed, it is only in this country that we pray and we think, yet we do not act. Yes, mass shootings continue to happen. Yes, mass shootings will continue to happen. But it is not only up to our politicians, it is also up to us as a society to be well-informed and organized on these matters. A mass shooting happened. Okay, review the politicians national landscape, also at the local level. What can you do about that? Vote. Do not just pray and think. Vote. Organize. Protest. Yes, we can do that. We can do those things. Gun reform. Yes, we can do that. If our grassroots efforts are stronger than just our prayers and thoughts. There is a substantive, effective way to combat this issue, to combat gun violence. We have become desensitized to things like this because over time, it has been clear in our government that this is never going to get done. We are never going to get any type of gun legislation passed. If a school shooting in 2012 couldn't move politicians, what do you think a school shooting in 2022, just days before summer started, would move politicians? It is up to us as civilians to start wanting to make change. It is up to us to start wanting to make those efforts, to start wanting to create those grassroots campaigns, to not only to organize, but also to increase our political participation, to increase our awareness, but also to enhance our sense of community, to become closer and connected, not just with people on one side of the political spectrum, but also people on both sides of the political spectrum, to sit down and have mature, comprehensive debates on gun violence, and to speak about that in a way that is respective of each person's decision, but also in a way that we can come to a uniformed collective consensus on what to do about this as a country. Because it really is ridiculous that every single year we beat the year before of gun deaths in America that we've had. It is really ridiculous that every single year in the United States of America, with just us as one country combined, we hold more deaths than three countries combined in Europe. That says something about our culture. That says something about who we are as a people. What are we going to do about that? It also says something about us that as a culture, as a people, as a country, we do not have a stable, effective mental health system in this country. We do not respond to that in a way that it needs to be responded to. We do not fund that in a way that it needs to be funded. What can we do as a country to effectively create a stable, functioning, premier mental health system that prevents actions like these from happening by getting people of that sort, get the help they need to talk to people, to vocalize those thoughts so that things like these cannot happen? Yet we live in a culture where it is so hyperpartisan, it is so disconnected from reality that we no longer have a sense of community. People can no longer just talk to each other because we are so closed in. We are so hyperpartisan. We are so anti-people. We stay within our own circles. We stay within our own political spectrum. And yes, that is fair. But it also is concerning that we have lost that in America. We have lost that. It is also worth understanding that in events like these, when little children die, when babies are killed, it is worth understanding why. Why? Why do people like this go after and the innocent children, the innocent people, people that they never have even come in contact with in most cases? Why do they do what they do? We're going to get live answers to those questions next with an expert you are going to want to hear. Stay with me.
I love my new home. I always wanted a house with historic architecture, but it might be too Victorian.
Hey, gosh, interesting hemline on those pants.
Yes, I do believe they're called pants.
Pardon me.
No, pardon me. At least Geico makes bundling my home and car insurance easy. I save so much.
I have come to call upon...
Just text me. While I'm heading up,
It's a ghost.
For bundling made easy, go to geico.com.
It's called self-care.
Joining me now for the interview is Dr. Gerald Shana Wolf. He is a licensed psychoanalyst and the author of The Mass Killer. Dr. Shana Wolf, thank you so much for coming on the Jeremiah Patterson Show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
My first question to you is regarding the topic of this book and the history that's in it. What exactly drove you to write this book? And why did you feel the need to tell these stories?
Because it seems like we have a crisis in our society. You know, every week we hear of another mass killing. Mm-hmm. It's just like an epidemic right now in our country. We have twice as many mass murders as any other country in the world. I just felt it needs to be addressed. Why are we having them? What can be done about it?
Is there a psychological explanation that goes with the U.S. as to why we have so much? Because we do see in other countries where there are mass shootings as well, but it's not as many. It's not as insurmountable like our numbers are. Is there a psychological explanation just in the U.S. basically that we can say, or is it something that more deals with like the laws or something?
No, that's what I went into in my book, The Psychological Explanation. I'm a psychoanalyst. I just think that our society, our culture right now is disturbed. It's psychologically disturbed. Individual people have disturbances, which everybody knows. You can be schizophrenic, you can be borderline personality, etc. Well, I believe that cultures can be disturbed too. And our culture right now has a split personality. Yeah. It's divided, and it's absolutely divided. One side demonizes the other side, but doesn't look at its own demon qualities. This is what disturbed people do. Disturbed people are not able to look at themselves objectively. They're only able to look at other people and blame other people for their problems. So this is what's happening also in our culture. It's a disturbed culture, and that also means it's disturbed. It has disturbed child rearing, disturbed parenting. How people are brought up today is disturbed, and I go into that. I go into the childhoods of six mass killers in my book, and each of them has a different childhood, but all of them have severe traumas in their childhood.
Just based off of that, can you go in a little bit to that in how exactly just that horrific upbringing can influence upcoming mass shooters?
Okay. Well, let me just talk about some of them. Adam Lanza is the first person I wrote about in my book. Adam Lanza was in Connecticut, and he is a mass murderer. He was like, I think he was 19 or still a teenager when he did it. And he went to the school where his mother had once worked and shot up like first and second grade students, very young students. Now, what happened to him in his early childhood? His mother and father didn't get along. They were always fighting, and his older sister got a different kind of upbringing than he did. His older sister was was looked up to, and she did well in school, while he, the second child, was neglected. His mother was a very angry woman, and she her favorite pastime was to go to shooting places where she could practice shooting her guns. I speculate in the book that she must have had a lot of anger at people to want to go off and shoot guns all the time. People who shoot guns often visualize people they want to shoot when they go to the places where they shoot their guns. She didn't really pay much attention to Adam. And when a boy or a girl, but in this case a boy, is raised in an when from babyhood on he is neglected, that's very has a very severe consequence on his personality development. Not only did his mother neglect him, but she also demonized him. She saw him, there was one time when she hired a babysitter to take care of him, and she warned the babysitter not to look at his eyes because his eyes were demonic. This is how she treated her son. She demonized him. And he developed, I think probably many people thought he had I'm getting blocked here. He was on the spectrum. He was on the spectrum. And as he grew up, he was a very isolated personality. He didn't really associate with people in his school. So this severe neglect that he was raised with, and a mother, then there was a divorce. He lost his father. His father went away, so he was only with his mother, and that had a large effect on him. And when he finally did his shooting, the first person he shot was his mother. He went into her bedroom and shot her, which shows how angry he was at her. Because she was the kind of mother who would tell him how much she loved him, but he didn't feel that from her. He felt like she didn't care about him at all. She would take him to shooting ranges and let him and have him shoot with her. So she taught him how to use guns, and it was her guns he used when he went to the killing. So she did that with him, but there was no real love. I think he shot children. He shot young children, first and second grade, maybe even some in kindergarten. 20, I think 23 of them. He just went one morning and started walking through the halls and opening doors and shooting young kids. I think it was because when he was a young kid, he was completely neglected, and he felt jealous of young kids in the school who were feeling happy about their childhoods. That's one case. There are five other cases in the book. So, people like that, they have a traumatic childhood, but then they also go into a culture, American culture, that is all disturbed too. It doesn't help them. If they try to seek help, the help they get often is off the mark. That what they see on television every day is a lot of mass killings. This guy saw mass killings, and he admired mass killers. He thought that they went out in a blaze of glory, and that was the only way maybe that he could achieve any kind of recognition, was by doing that.
In terms of American culture and how disturbed it is with glorifying violence. In almost every modern television show, you see at least several guns or several shooting instances. And just around the discussion of, someone like that going to get help, not to justify what they did, but to get help to talk about stuff like this. Are there like effective strategies to destigmatizing mental health discussions and encouraging individuals to seek help before resorting to violence?
I don't think there are enough places like that. Let's say we could have special clinics for potential mass murderers. Have you seen any clinics like that around? No. But if there were, I think a lot of them would go to these clinics where they could be understood, where there would be experts in this kind of thing, who would be able to listen to them and let them get stuff off their chest. He had a lot, all of these mass killers have a lot to get off their chest, but they never do. None of them had any kind of effective psychotherapy. So if there were actual places throughout the country set up for, potential mass killers or people with violent fantasies, clinics like this all over for people to go in for kids and others to go into, that would be a help.
And on that front, with seeking help like that, and in terms of reform, are there examples from other countries that we as a nation can draw from that they have gotten more successful in terms of mental health advancements to avoid stuff like this from happening? Are there examples that we can draw from to do better here?
Well, I can't really speak to that. I haven't really studied how they handle mass killings in other countries. I was just focused on the United States.
Okay. In terms of societal factors that contribute to the occurrence of mass shootings, are there any specific, cultural or social elements that play a role in mass shootings happening? And I wanted to speak to you about why exactly we become so desensitized as a culture when these things continue to happen.
Well, yeah, you see, mass killings, I think they started in the late 60s. They've only been happening in the last few decades, which is why people say, well, it's the availability of guns. But guns have always been available in America. But mass killings have only happened in the last few decades because of what's been happening in our culture. What has been happening in our culture? Well, I think, as I said, it's a divided culture, and it has more and more violence in it. I mean, if you watch, you pointed this out, if you watch, go to the movies. What percentage of movies do you think have violent themes?
Probably about 99%.
And one of the main themes is revenge.
Exactly.
I mean, we glorify revenge in our movies. And that's so disturbed. That's so disturbed. Because revenge never has positive outcomes. For a moment, it might have a positive outcome, but in the long term, it only begets more revenge.
So the United States does have twice as many killings than any other country in the world. Of course, in 2018, I remember that there were just rampant mass shootings, and it just went on and on and on, in Las Vegas as well as other parts of the country. I guess my question to you is, given that history and our current trajectory, do you expect things to get worse from here?
I think things are going to get worse until some we need some wise leader to come along who will know how to effectively deal with the situation. And what will a wise leader do? I think one thing he could do is to change the communication in our culture. People aren't talking to each other. They're yelling at each other. I would say that the leader should have monthly town halls. And in these monthly town halls, people from all walks of life, representatives of all different points of view, would be invited to these monthly forums, and there would be strict rules about how they communicate. No name calling, no talking over one other people or shouting over them. It would be conducted in strict rules like debates are conducted. Everybody's allowed to express their point of view. And in this kind of climate, people would get to know each other, get to know behind the politics, get to know each other as human beings. So that's one thing that I think a wise leader would do. Open the communication in the country by using monthly town halls.
To speak to just this question, which is probably the main central part of your book, why do mass killers study other mass killers and try to replicate what they did, but in a much more worse way? Like, 'cause I've seen the concept that, oh, if this person got this much bodies, I'm going to try to aim for much more. Why do they admire each other in their work?
Because the people that they identify with are people like them, people who are full of rage and cannot find a constructive way to channel that rage. So the way that they can channel it is in a negative way by killing the most people. At least that there's some in their minds, there's some kind of glory at being a mass killer and killing more people than anybody else and making a statement. Hey, we've got problems in our society, and look, see what I just did? See? And you didn't do anything about me. I mean, they're getting some at negative attention that way because they never got attention the positive way.
Dr. Shane Wolf, my last question to you is regarding the rage and the amount of killings that have multiplied in the US over the years. How can we as a society, from the psychological and just uniformed perspective, how can we prevent mass killings from continuing in the future?
Okay, so one idea that I already presented was the monthly or weekly town halls. And I think that we have to put more emphasis on mental illness in our society. We need to handle it better. By having more clinics, like I suggested, clinics for mass, specifically for mass killers. I think more attention should be paid to the clues. All mass killers give clues. They all talk about what they're going to do. It's amazing, but they do. They talk about it to friends. They post it online. They even go to clinics and tell them, but nobody stops them. Nobody takes them seriously enough to stop them. So we need to pay more attention. We need to do more education. The country, USA, needs to have maybe a secretary of mass killings or something. And that secretary of mass killings should focus educational things like there should be a whole educational program by the secretary to get people aware of who mass killings are, where they are in their neighborhoods, what kind of things they do, what kind of things they say, and what needs to be done by each individual to step in and stop the procedure. So that whole educational system could be there. I think that a lot of the violence that's happening in our countries is because of mass movements, political movements. Political movements in our country, the gay movement, feminist movement, the Black Rights Movement, all the movements have gotten out of hand. They have, in a sense, taken over our culture, and changed our values in not a good way. It's not a way that unifies the country. A country has to be unified under a single value system in order to work well. And we're not unified under a single value system. And these I have suggested in my book that political movements should have to register with the government and should have to follow rules in order to exist, or else be penalized or perhaps banned from existing if they don't follow the rules.
I know I said last question, but this is my last question for real. Are you optimistic about the future as someone who has studied this over the years and has even written a book on it? Are you optimistic that we will eventually get it right and quench this epidemic?
No, I'm not optimistic. I've been on a few podcasts, and I've talked about my book to a lot of people, and they don't agree with my answers. No, we can't agree. That's the problem. We can't agree on how to solve the problem. Even the wisest person, even if Abraham Lincoln came back, or William Shakespeare, nobody would be listened to these days. It seems like it's gone too far. I mean, I certainly hope, I mean, that something can be done, but I'm not optimistic.
Okay, last question for real this time, because that was a really good point. We've become so polarized as a society that much of our opinions and much of our statements and our ideologies are so isolated and central to who we are that we have lost that connection. We've lost that sense of community with people. And so this definitely does stifle exactly how we can come to a consensus on this issue. I guess, does that play a role into how society impacts mass shootings by being so isolated and polarized that we can't come to an agreement?
Yeah, exactly. We're divided. It's family, a family that's divided, where the mother and father can't agree on anything, and they're always fighting. How does that make the children feel? They're very disturbed by that. And every citizen is very disturbed. Even though they may take sides in the matter, they still feel disturbed because, actually it's taking sides that keeps the conflict going.
Once again, my guest is Dr. Gerald Shane Wolf, the author of The Mass Killer and also a licensed psychoanalyst. Dr. Shane Wolf, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You are a very good host. Very, I guess you look very young to be doing this. Well, how old are you?
I'm 18.
You're 18. Well, very, very good. You are a very astute for an 18-year-old.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. All
All
right.
right.
Again, I completely hate doing episodes like these, where it's extremely emotional, and especially talking on hard-hitting topics like these. But it is essential to have this conversation, to have a uniformed, mature conversation about issues like this in our country, to help resolve this, to help, get things done, politically speaking and action-wise, and on a grassroots level. If the mothers of Dunblane could do it in 1996, we can surely try in 2023, if there even is any of that hope left. But yet we are persistent, hurt, but we are persistent. And, maybe we can make it one day. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. It is with that partial optimism, I guess you could say, that I end this episode, even though I'm pretty much pessimistic about things these days. But hopefully there is change, as mass shootings most likely will get worse, just statistically looking at the numbers, and as it continues to go year after year in this country. Maybe we can strike up some type of change where the people who are marching and demanding action become the people who are creating the legislation to stop these things from happening. If we can just bridge the gap between those two things, maybe we can get legislation to prevent the next mass shooting from happening. The next elementary school kid from being killed before Christmas. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Take care and remember to stay positive and inspired. We will see you again tomorrow for another episode. And then I think we're doing about three more episodes. And then that's a wrap for this year because we're taking a break. And then we'll see you again on January 6th, 2024, for a TJPS special report. All right, take care.